Thank you, Pastor Eric and Natasha, your great hosts and hostess for us. This is the second time we've been here. I think it's only once before we've been here, a couple of years ago, but we looked forward to this. It's a beautiful place and a beautiful group of people, and so it's great to be back. I think Pastor Eric said I had 2.5 hours because we're going to do half the Bible this morning. I also have a class that I'm offering right now online called the Quick Bible Timeline Mastery Course. It's a 13-lesson all-online course. It's an extended version of what we're going to do in the next couple of weeks. So if you'd like to be part of that, all I'm asking for that is any kind of a donation to my Aspect Ministries nonprofit. So that, anyway, the commercial stuff now out of the way, and let's talk about the Bible. Now, what I have found in my years of ministry, and I've been in ministry since I was 20, I'm 71 now, and I have found that most Christians, even they've been in church most of their lives, it's just like Pastor Eric said, they have segmented knowledge of the Bible. They have their Bible in boxes, the Matthew box, the Romans box, the Genesis box, the Revelation box. And what I found out was that they don't understand, a lot of people don't understand how it all connects. So I got into this thing when I was on staff at a church down in Fresno. The pastor down there, he preached 130 messages in the Gospel of John. So what is that, 2.5 years in John? And I kind of said, you know, there's other books in the Bible you might want to look at. And so we had this thing, kind of this kidding thing back and forth. He says, well, I suppose you could do John in one sermon. I said, I can do the Bible in one sermon. It's one of those arrogant things guys kind of get into, you know. And so he said, all right, how about 3 weeks from now? And I went, oh my goodness, now I actually have to do it. So I did this sermon, you know, I did this in one Sunday. I'm spreading this today into two Sundays. But I noticed something when I walked out of the sermon that day, when I was standing in the back shaking people's hands. More people, lifelong Christians, walking out saying, I had no idea how it all connected. Thank you. I thought, well, maybe I should do this again sometime. So that's what we're trying to do here. So we're going to see if we can summarize the Bible in one or two sermons. In this series, we're going to do two sermons, try to break it up a little bit. So what we're going to be looking at here are four phases. Now, I've divided the Bible into 12 periods, which fit it neatly into four phases of how God works. People can do this all kinds of different ways, but I would like to do it this way. We're going to see how God worked in the ancient world, way, way back, thousands of years ago. We're going to see how he worked through early Israel. That's what we're going to cover today, those two. Next week, we'll be looking at how God worked through scattered Israel, as Israel was dispersed out of their land. And then we're going to see how God is at work today through a new covenant from the time of the apostles, Jesus and the apostles, on to our own present day. So let's start with phase one, and I'm going to have to move very quickly here. Don't expect any depth from me today. It's all just 30,000 view over the Bible and how the big picture of how God has been working. So God, how did he work in the ancient world? How did he work way back, way back? And we'll see that. We're going to pick as our key verse here, Genesis 12, 1 through 3. So let me read it. The Lord said to Abram, remember his name was still Abram, it wasn't Abraham yet, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. Didn't say head southeast 250 miles. He just said, keep walking, I'll tell you when you get there. I mean, that's faith. That's the first thing he asked him to do, was just trust me. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. I mean, this is a big calling. I am going to redeem the world through you. Start walking, I'll let you know when you get there. Sound like anything you've ever been through? Maybe a smaller version of that. So this first period of Bible history is the period of beginnings. You call it the beginnings. You can call it origins, whatever you want. But there are four main events in this period. It really is only the first 11 chapters of Genesis. We don't know what the dates were. I'm not going to try to assign dates to it. But it was a long, long time ago, several thousand years at least. And so creation is when, you know, the first two chapters of Genesis. Chapter one is the big picture, how he created things in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And then chapter two, I like to consider a sidebar, which focuses on the creation of human beings, how Adam was scooped out of the dust and how Eve was separated out of his side and became his companion. And, and all of that, and everything is beautiful, everything is wonderful. I wish the Bible stopped at Genesis chapter 2. But unfortunately, something happened. And that's Genesis chapter 3, which brings up the second event, which is the fall of the human race. Now, here's what happened. I don't think we fully understand the gravity of what happened. Because they had loved God. They knew God. They walked with God. They loved him. They talked to him. They trusted him. They put their faith in him. He was their center. He was everything. And what happened in chapter 3 was the serpent tempted Eve and Adam. And Adam gets the full weight of the blame here. He tempted them to say, I'm going to transfer my faith, my love, my loyalty from God to the serpent. And he did that by tricking them into thinking that it would benefit them, that they would actually be like God if they did that. And what did it do? It brought death and destruction and darkness and hopelessness and despair and all of the things that you and I experience on a regular basis. And so what we're going to see is, and this is my understanding, that God is always, the whole point is to get us to transfer our faith back to him. But we can't be transferred as we are, we have to be redeemed first. And it's all about transferring that faith from ourselves and the serpent back to him through Jesus Christ. So that's the fall. Then the flood. So the human race fell. Adam and Eve failed. They had two sons, remember, Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel, so the godly one was done, and the ungodly one prevailed. It looked like it was all over. And then there was a third son named Seth who tried to be godly. His line was godly for a while. But then the line of Cain, you can see this, it corrupts the line of Seth until it gets down to one family. One family from the line of Seth named Noah and his family. And God said, I can't work with these people. I can only work with one family. That's all that's left. So he has Noah and his sons build this boat. A couple months ago, we were back in Kentucky. We got to see that replica of Noah's Ark. It was just awesome. If you ever get a chance to do that, it's amazing. But, you know, you think, I'm not sure Noah and his three sons actually built the whole thing. They probably contracted people out. I don't know. It just seemed like a huge project. But they, you know the story of the Ark. I won't go into that. But God saved one family and representatives of the animals to repopulate the earth. He said, I've got to start over again. I cannot deal with these people. It's hell on earth. And if we think it's bad now, before the flood, it really was hell on earth. And so God started over again. And you think, you know, all these objections, is God unfair for drowning people? It got so bad, he could do nothing else. It was a mercy that he did that and started over again. All right, great. The family of Noah was sobered after the flood. I mean, wouldn't you be? I mean, like, okay, we're going to really mind our P's and Q's now. Three generations, and they're back at it again. And God says, fill the earth. I want you to be stewards over the earth. They wouldn't do it. They congregated in one city, built this tower. Now, I don't know the significance of the tower exactly, but it certainly had to do with communing with demonic spirits and getting back to what the devil had promised them. Oh, you can be just like God. And they built this tower, and God said, well, I'm not going to destroy the earth again, but I am going to disperse them. So that if I don't disperse them, they'll cooperate in such a way that they'll be irredeemable again. So what did he do? He scattered them through the earth by confusing speech, confusing language. And so off they went to the four corners of the earth. And now who's representing God in the world? Nobody. They're all idol worshipers. They're all in darkness. And God reaches down in Genesis chapter 12 and picks out one man, Abram, that we read about. So this is the first phase. And we come to the second period of Bible history, which is the patriarchs. Patriarchs are male family heads. He picks out Abraham. Now, it doesn't give us any reason like Abraham was really a great guy or he was real smart. There's no particular reason. He says, I've chosen you because I've chosen you. And so Abram is picked up. Abram means father in Hebrew, Avram. And so he picks him out. Now, Abram's 75 years old. His wife is 65, Sarai. And they pick them out. And he says, you know, I just read it. I'm going to send you to this land. I'm going to bless the world through you. You know, you're going to be a mighty nation. And, you know, I'm going to summarize the story here, but Abram says, oh, just one little, excuse me, Lord, one little problem. I'm 75 years old. My wife is 65. No children. And God says, come outside your tent. So, you know, you can picture Abram walking outside his tent. Look at the sky, you know, stars. You can imagine the stars in the sky. No pollution in those days. And he says, can you count the stars? That's how many descendants I'm going to give you. And Abraham did what we are supposed to do. He transferred his faith from himself and the devil to God. And said, okay, if that's what you say, then that's what I believe. And God counted him righteous on the spot. So Abraham went on, and of course, you know, it's all great and everything. I have some questions, though, myself. Because how long was it before Isaac came along? I know there was Ishmael in between, but that was kind of Sarah and Abraham's idea. How long was it before Isaac came along? 25 years. 25 years. You'd think God would mention that? It's going to be 25 years. And that's why Ishmael comes along, because they got impatient and they went ahead and tried to do some themselves. And Isaac comes along, but he waited so that it could be nothing but a miracle. Because remember, Abraham was like 80-something years old when he fathered Ishmael. So that was a human thing. He had to wait until it was completely impossible. And Isaac comes along. Isaac means laughter in Hebrew. You can imagine the laughter when that little boy was born out of this 90-year-old woman and this 100-year-old man. And so Isaac comes along. Now, he's not the man his father was. Abraham was an adventurer. He was up for big things. Isaac's more of a stay-at-home person. Now remember, he grows up, and when he's a teenager, God says to his father, all right, now that you have a descendant, the one I'm going to bless, I want you to go sacrifice him. Now, Abraham had been taught faith over many, many years, and that's part of why it took so long. He had been taught faith, and so by this point, Abraham says, look, this makes no sense to me. In fact, it seems wrong. But if God says so, I'm going to do it. And so it was only at the point where the knife came to the throat that God said, okay, stop. Now I see. It wasn't that God didn't know. God knows. But we have to live it out. We have to actually embody it first. And that's what God saw in Abram. Then, of course, his name has changed to Abraham, father of a multitude. Isaac means laughter. Jacob comes along. Jacob is the son of Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there's a long story behind all of that. But Jacob comes along, and Jacob's brother Esau, remember, Esau's technically the firstborn, and he's not a man that cares anything about spiritual things at all. Jacob means snatcher, grabber, basically means cheater. And that's what he is. And he cheats his brother out of his birthright. And Esau is justifiably angry. And so Jacob has to flee, right? He goes off to his uncle's back in Syria where his mother came from. And so he goes back and lives with him. And guess what? The cheater gets cheated. Because remember, he falls head over heels in love with his first cousin, folks. First cousin. I guess in those days it wasn't such a bad thing like it would be today. But he falls in love with Rachel. Oh, Rachel's beautiful. She's Miss Syria. She's the most beautiful girl he's ever seen. And she has an older sister who's not Miss Syria. And after 7 years, promising to work the bride price off for 7 years, he's supposed to get Rachel, and what does he get? He gets Leah thrown in. And he doesn't, I guess he's drunk or something. He doesn't realize what's happened to him until the next morning. And so he has Leah. Then eventually his father-in-law says, well, yeah, I'll throw Rachel into the deal. So now you've got two sisters. It's not a great situation. Eventually they throw their handmaids into the mix. They get into this childbearing contest thing going on. And pretty soon Jacob ends up with 12 sons and a daughter. And it's not a happy family. It's not a functional family. It's a dysfunctional family. God uses dysfunctional people to do amazing things. You don't want to be in Jacob's family. I'm sorry, you don't. And so Jacob has to flee back eventually from his father-in-law, who's becoming more and more of a tyrant. He flees back. He has to face his brother. He reconciles with his brother. In the meantime, he wrestles with God. And he finally gets brought down to where he needs to be, a humble man of faith. Or he begs the angel of the Lord to let him go after a wrestling match. And finally he says, okay, now I can work with you. And he changes his name from Jacob, deceiver, to Israel, powerful with God. And so from then on, he's known by this other name. And so Jacob becomes Israel. He has all these sons. These sons are not necessarily good boys. Read about what some of those boys do. Reuben shamed his father. And some of the other boys, I mean, they were off. That's why Joseph, who was Mr. Perfect, you have a sibling like that, Mr. Perfect or Miss Perfect? He's born with a halo over his head. He's smart. He's handsome. He's dad's favorite. I mean, it's obvious. Dad gives him this special jacket that, you know, you're my favorite boy. I love you, my son. And the other, you know, the other boys are like, you know, what are we? And so he even sends Joseph out to sort of report on his brothers. The brothers are off doing things. They're herding sheep or something. And who knows what they're doing? Maybe they're going into town and doing crazy things at night. We don't know what they're doing. But Jacob's supposed to bring a Joseph's supposed to bring a report back to his father. And so the brothers are sick and tired of being spied on by their smug little brother who can interpret dreams. Remember the dream he had? Hey, guys, I've got this great dream I've got to tell you about. The sun and the moon and 11 stars all bowed down to me. Isn't that great? And it's obvious. They know what that means. It's them. And so they have this chance. They throw him down a well, and they're going to kill him, and they got to figure, okay, what do we tell Dad, though? What do we tell Dad? We got to have something to tell Dad. So while they're trying to figure that out, two of the brothers, Reuben and Judah, say, we shouldn't kill him. He is our brother. Oh, there's some slave traders. Let's sell him. Plus, we get some money out of the deal. It's a great thing. What do we tell Dad? Well, we take his special little jacket, and we put blood on it, and we tear it up, and we say a lion ate him. And so they go back, and Jacob, of course, he's grief-stricken because his favorite boy is gone, the only son. Well, it's not the only son, but it's his son from his beloved Rachel, who's gone, and you guys are just the sons of Leah and the handmaidens, and, you know, my beloved Rachel, this is all I have left of her, you know, and so all of this, and so finally he's down in Egypt, and what happens? It's all lost. He is a slave, and then his master's wife, what she does? She doesn't betray him. She frames him. She frames him, and he's thrown in prison. I mean, it's all lost. It's done. God's plan's done. But God's never done. So he interprets the dream, this troubling dream that Pharaoh has, that these fat cows come out of the Nile, and then these skinny cows come out of the Nile, and the skinny cows eat the fat cows. What does it mean? He knows it means something. The Pharaoh's smart enough to know it means something. His people can't interpret it, so somebody from the prison goes, oh, there's a Hebrew there that can do that. He gets called out of prison. Believe me, there's a lot more detail, I'm sure you know. But he gets called out of prison, and he's able to tell the Pharaoh, look, God has told you what's going to happen. There's going to be 7 years of harvest. We won't know what to do with it all. And then 7 years of famine that will just eat it all up if we're not careful. And so Pharaoh promotes him to being prime minister. I mean, this is what God does. He takes a hopeless situation, a slave who's in jail, and makes him prime minister. Just like that. God can turn it around. Do we believe that? I don't sometimes. I don't believe that sometimes. In my worst moments, I don't believe that. Excuse me, Lord, but that's true. We have to pull ourselves together and remember what we believe. And so he's now prime minister of Egypt. Everybody's starving. Even his brothers come to buy grain. I won't go into that story. But he does see them. He's there. They don't recognize him. It's been, what, I think it's been 20 years or something like that. And so he sees them. He accuses them of being spies. You know, there's a big story back and forth. Finally, he reveals himself to his brothers. And I will tell you what he says to them in Hebrew. He says, Ani Yosef. That's Hebrew. Ani Yosef. I am Joseph. And so the brothers are going, oh my gosh, is he going to kill us now? Is he going to get revenge? And he says, no, because as he's been taught by faith in all of his experiences. He's been humbled, which he needed to be humbled, but he's also been taught by faith. He says, look, I see the big picture now. God brought me here to save you. I'm going to save you. And he did. He said, go back home, get all your families, and bring Dad. Bring them all down here to Egypt. They came to Egypt as 70 people. There in Egypt, we find that they grew, and they grew. So that brings us to the next. That brings us to the end of the phase, which is that God can accomplish his plan with a few or even just one. He just needs one or a few. He had to start over again after Adam. He had to start over again after Abel. He had to start over again after Seth. He had to start again after Noah. But he'll start again. Then God works through early Israel. Our key verse here, Psalm 22, verses 27 through 28. Here's Israel's purpose. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. This is Israel's calling. He didn't just call them for no reason. He called them to be a light to the nations, just as he's calling all of us. And so we find that Israel sometimes did that, and sometimes they didn't do that. So we get to the time, several generations after the time of Joseph, and Joseph is gone. There's a new regime in Egypt. They look at all the huge population explosion among the Israelites, from 70 people to probably several million in, I don't know, two or three generations. I don't know how that's possible, but I guess it is. And so these Israelites are, and the Egyptians are saying, if we're not careful, we've got a big group of foreigners living among us that could overthrow us if we're not careful. So what do? The baby boys have to die, and we enslave the rest of them. They're enslaved, and the baby boys have to die, because you don't want any baby boys. They'll become soldiers. So this is the time when Moses is born. His mother does what the Pharaoh says. She does throw him in the Nile. You know, she follows his orders. It's just that he never said anything about a basket that was watertight. And so she put him in there where Pharaoh's daughter could find him. And then he's raised as an Egyptian, but he never forgets that he's an Israelite. Because remember that his sister was there to say, I know a lady that can nurse him for you, ma'am. I know a lady. And it's his own mother. And she teaches him. You know, and how much she could instill in that child while he was still nursing, but enough to where he never forgot who he was. And so he grows up and he sees the injustice and he tries to take care of it. I guess I'm the deliverer, so I better deliver. He kills an Egyptian, one down and a million to go, you know, or whatever it was. But somebody sees him, and guess what? He's a marked man. So he has to flee to the wilderness. God's got to deal with him. He cannot use you till he deals with you. And so he spends 40 years herding sheep until finally, I think he's given up hope. And God says, now you're ready. So he speaks to him out of the burning bush. He says, go back and tell the Pharaoh, you need to let my people go. He goes back. He says, I can't do it. I can't. All right, then bring your brother if you insist. Your brother can do it. He's a good speaker. And so he and Aaron go back and they confront the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says no how many times? 10. Because Moses said, every time you say no to my God, there's going to be a plague on Egypt. 10 plagues. The last one was the death of the firstborn male child of every household. And that's when God said to Moses, go back and tell the Israelites, if they don't want to be part of that, they need to kill a male lamb to represent that firstborn, to take the place of that firstborn child, spread the blood on the doorpost of your house, and the death angel will pass over. And that's where the Feast of Passover every spring comes from. So the Jewish Feast of Passover. Our Easter is sort of connected to that, or sort of tied to that in a way. So the Israelites finally are allowed to go. The Egyptians are saying, go, just go, go, go. And they leave. Then Pharaoh changes his mind. They're trapped against the Red Sea. I mean, again, leaving out a lot of the details. And finally, you know, they're trapped by the Egyptian army, and their backs are to the sea. God says, Moses, put your staff over the water. And that makes no sense. And yet the waters part. Israel goes through. The Egyptians try to pursue. The waters cover the Egyptians. Now they've lost their army. Egypt is in ruins. And you can even read, and if you go back and pick the right Egyptian texts, they talk about times when Egypt was devastated. I bet you one of those times was the Exodus. So Moses takes the people across. They arrive 50 days after they leave Egypt. They arrive at Mount Sinai, and they have this great Pentecost, you know, moment. The Feast of Pentecost remembers when Moses and the people received the law on Mount Sinai. So it's 50 days after Passover. And so they come to Mount Sinai. The mountain is smoking and burning, and they hear the rumbling of God's voice, and Moses goes up on the mountain and he receives the law. How many commandments? Well, 10 that are the easy ones to remember, 613 specific commands in the Law of Moses. If you ever see a Jewish guy with his prayer shawl, count the strings on the tassel. 613. One for each commandment. That's just a little fun fact. Then they are told, go conquer the promised land. The land I gave your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that land that they were living in then, that's yours. Go get it. And the Israelites say, well, let's check it out first. Like, you know, we have to sort of verify this from you, God. I'm not sure. And what do? They send out the spies, the 12 spies, and the spies come back saying, I don't know. They got fortified cities. They've got chariots. They've got giants. Those people are mean people. I don't think so. But God, who parted the sea and did the plagues on Egypt and thundered on the mountain, told them it was doable. But they said, no, I don't think so. So God said, I can't use this generation. The only ones I can use from this generation are Joshua and Caleb, the two spies that said, yeah, but God will help us. So he says, you guys, spend 40 years. I want every last one of the generation over 20 to die in the wilderness because you would not trust me, even after everything I've done for you. So they die in the wilderness. It's only their children, 20 and below, or those born during that time that are able to go into the land. And that generation actually was more faithful than their parents. And so they go into the land under Joshua. By this time, Moses is dead. And they go into the land, and they conquer Jericho. How do they conquer it? No military strategy. It's trumpets. It's a marching band. They send the marching band around the city. And the walls fall down, and they go in, and they conquer the city. And, you know, and only Rahab and her family are saved because she said, no, I want to be with you guys. I'm with you. And so they save her. She becomes an ancestor of Jesus, by the way. It's amazing. And so then they go and they conquer some other cities, and there's some ups and downs, but they spend a generation conquering the land that God promised them. They leave 2.5 tribes to the east side of the river. Their warriors are supposed to help the others, but eventually their families settle on the east side of the Jordan River in what's now Jordan and Syria. That'd be Reuben and Gad and part of the tribe of Manasseh. And the other, 9.5 tribes are on the west side. And they get the tribal territory. So let's see if we can find a map of that. By the way, that's the Torah. That's the law that they receive on Mount Sinai. If you go to a Jewish synagogue, that's the ceremonial scripture that they use. I should mention that I skipped the tabernacle. Let's talk about that. So while they're in the wilderness, they are told to set up this worship center. It's a movable center. It's basically a tent. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but the tent is surrounded by this wall made out of fabric. And the Levite tribe is set aside. So one of the 12 tribes is set aside as priests and social workers and religious workers, that sort of thing. And they are supposed to be teaching the people. And so what you're supposed to do, if you have broken one of the commandments that requires sacrifice, you show up at the tabernacle with let's say it's a sheep that you're supposed to bring. You bring the sheep, it can have no blemishes, no markings, no defects, and a Levite meets you at the entrance. So one of the Levite members meets you at the entrance. He examines and verifies that your offering is perfect. He calls for one of the sons of Aaron, who's also part of that tribe. Aaron and Moses were Levites. He calls for one of the sons of Aaron, who is a priest, and in Hebrew, the priests are called Kohanes. A Kohen is a priest. Jewish people with the last name Cohen, they're recording that. And so the Kohen comes over. He has you place your hands on the animal's head, transferring your transgression to the animal, symbolically, I guess. He takes a knife and with one stroke cuts both arteries here. The animal bleeds to death. I mean, it's a very gory thing. They siphon off the blood. They sprinkle the blood on the altar. Part of the animal is burned on this altar. Part of it is the Levite's portion. I think it's the right hindquarters, the Levite's portion. I mean, they gotta have some kind of living somehow, so they're in the butchery business. The rest is given back to you for a meal to celebrate that your sin has been dealt with. And so inside the tabernacle, and I will let you look at the screen there because I can't necessarily point to it, but you've got the altar outside, the bronze altar that's always burning. That's where the blood is sprinkled. the laver, which is a great big basin for water because it's a very messy business. They have to wash. Inside the holy place would be the table of bread, 12 loaves of bread baked every day to represent how God took care of the people in the wilderness by giving them manna every day. The altar of incense, which represents prayers. And the menorah, which is the light of God, the seven-branched candlestick, which is still a symbol of Judaism today, giving the only light in there. And then there's a curtain, and to the left you see the Ark of the Covenant, which has three items in it. A jar of that manna, Aaron's staff that had budded and borne almonds, and then the Ten Commandments are in there. And once a year, the high priest will go behind the curtain and make a sacrifice for all the people. Sprinkle the blood, not on the altar, but on the Holy of Holies, on that Ark of the Covenant. So that's their worship. And eventually that becomes a temple. We will see that, that it becomes a temple, eventually a permanent building under Solomon. The next period is tribal Israel and Canaan. Now we can assign some pretty firm dates. I believe the Exodus was around 1450 BC, my opinion. Others disagree, but that would make the entrance into Canaan somewhere around 1400 BC, so that's 3,400 years ago. And they enter the land, they conquer portions of Canaan, as I've said, they don't get all of it. I'll show you in a minute, in the next slide, how much God promised them and how little they actually possessed. Again, it's a lack of faith. They divide and they settle the territory by tribes. Each of the tribe gets a territory except Levi. Levi doesn't get one. They're scattered throughout all of the tribes to teach and to be the social workers and represent God. But there's still 12 tribal territories. So how does that work? It's because Joseph was considered the firstborn, even though he was nearly the lastborn. He's given the firstborn because he saved his brothers and because Reuben, the oldest, disgraced his father. So he got two portions. So that means his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were elevated to the status of their uncles. So Joseph has two tribes. So actually there's 13 tribes with Levi not getting any territory. That's the way it works. And so they go into this belief, unbelief cycles under the judges. So 350 years after the time of Joshua, the Israelites, sometimes they're faithful, sometimes they're unfaithful. They're still 12 separate tribes, really. And they're fighting against each other. In Judges chapter 5, there's a big victory. Deborah, the judge Deborah, and her general Barak, they defeat the Canaanites against impossible odds. And afterwards, she sings this song. She says, "Where were you, Dan? Where were you, Reuben? Where were you, Asher? You didn't come to help us. You guys were doing your own thing." You can see they were not united. They were just individual tribes, sort of united in worship, and that was it. And so you see they actually had different sort of ethnic makeups, these tribes, because they'd been apart so long. And so you see, these are the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth record this. Now I want to show you this this map. Look at the black is how much God said he would give them. Everything from the Euphrates to Egypt. They could have had all of that. Basically, the whole east coast of the Mediterranean could have been theirs. How much did they get? How much did they actually settle and possess? The red line is that. They possessed, what is that? Maybe a third, maybe a quarter. And then the blue is this current state of Israel. So even the current state of Israel doesn't even have some of the territory that they originally had because it was in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and the Palestinian zone, for that matter. This is the tribal territories, you can see. As near as we can figure, some of the landmarks aren't there anymore, so it's hard to tell exactly, but something like that. See, Manasseh was huge. It had two big chunks of land east and west of the Jordan River. So the next period is United Israel. This is when finally the tribes said, we haven't done that well as 12 separate tribes. We've been oppressed by people, and we want to be united. God said we were a single people, so let's unite as a single people. And we want a king. And Samuel, who's as important for his generation as Moses was to his, Samuel said, you don't want a king. Kings are abusive. Kings are tyrannical. You don't want a king. He'll tax you. He'll draft your sons into his army. He'll draft your daughters to be his cooks and his cleaners. And no, you don't want that. And the people said, no, yes, we do. And so they demanded a king. And so Samuel said, all right. So he anointed a king like what they wanted. His name was Saul, tribe of Benjamin. Not the royal tribe. Back in Genesis, it told us who the royal tribe was. Jacob said the royal tribe was going to be Judah. So they picked this guy from Benjamin. He looked the part, though. He was tall and handsome, and, you know, he looked good on a horse, I think. You know, he was kingly. His heart was not with God. And he made mistake after mistake after mistake. He disobeyed and disobeyed and disobeyed. And finally, God said, I am going to tear the kingdom out of your hand and give it to someone who would do a better job with it. And that's when he was sent to Bethlehem to anoint one of the sons of Jesse. And it was the last son of Jesse, was he, number 7 or 8, something like that? The baby, David, was the one he anointed. And David became this sort of king in waiting. And then when Saul found out about him, again, I'm leaving a lot of the story out, but Saul originally loved him because he killed Goliath. You know, oh good, this young man solved my problem. He killed Goliath, and he's a war hero. But then he realized the people love David more than me. So now he's jealous, and he tries to kill David. That's where a lot of those psalms that you read about, God, where are you? They're one step behind me, God. You better show up soon. Those kind of psalms, that's David fleeing from Saul. And so he eventually, you know, escapes. And Saul is killed in battle. And David becomes king over Israel. First over his own tribe of Judah, and then over the rest of all of Israel. So he's the second king of a united Israel. David's a great guy. He loves God deeply. He writes music and poetry for God. He organizes the Levites into choirs to sing, like, you know, beautiful music. Some of the first choir music is probably composed by David. It's amazing stuff. I mean, he just loves God. He expands the empire. He creates this empire for Israel. It's amazing. But he's got a weakness, and don't we all? What was David's weakness? Pretty girls. Yep. He liked pretty girls. In fact, he had plenty of his own, but he couldn't keep his hands off one of his bodyguard's wives. You know that story. It's just awful. And I won't go into a detail, but you know what happened there. And he got caught in this affair, and he killed the woman's husband. He had him killed. And then he got called out by the prophet Nathan, and he says, oh, please forgive me. And that's where that song that you sang, Created Me a Clean Heart, comes out of that experience. That's David saying, okay, God, I need to be cleansed from my heart needs to be cleansed. And so he wrote that psalm. And so David goes on, but after that time, David's life is not happy anymore. His family is in discord. A brother kills another brother. There are terrible things that happened in that family. And David really dies under a cloud. There's civil war in the kingdom. But then the second son of that woman becomes king. That's Solomon. I think she made a deal with him. You owe me, buddy. My son's going to be the next king. Because there were other sons. And so Solomon's king. And he's a great king. He loves God. He writes philosophy. He wrote probably the first opera called Song of Solomon. He collects proverbs, and he's an amazing man. And he does love God, but he's also taken away by wives. Now, I'm not blaming women here, but he's taken away by these foreign alliances that he makes with all these foreign women, and he permits them to have their idols, and he gets caught up in it himself. It's just awful. And so in the end, I believe Solomon did repent in the end, but he's carried away there, and his kingdom is really diminished because of his unfaithfulness. His son is an utter fool, Rehoboam, and he loses the kingdom out of arrogance. The 10 tribes in the north say, you've oppressed us enough, you're not listening to our needs, who needs you? And so the 10 tribes in the north separate out, and the Judah and Benjamin and some of the Levites separate out in the bottom. The northern tribes keep the name. I'm getting way ahead of myself here on the slides. The northern kingdom keeps the name Israel, as they've got the most population. The southern kingdom has to find a new name, and they name themselves after the leading tribe of Judah. So they're the house of Judah and the house of Israel. And you can see this from the prophets on. You can see that sometimes the prophets talk to the house of Israel, and they're not talking to the Judeans. And sometimes it's the house of Judah, and they're not talking to the Israelites. It's two separate groups. And so these Bible books are like what you were in First Kings recently, and you know, some of these prophets that talk about this time in the divided kingdom. Israel in the north, they never served God, because immediately Jeroboam, who led them off into separating, he didn't want them going back to Jerusalem to worship with the Jews. So he created idol worship centers, and they, most of them, reverted into idolatry. They had many different kings, some really horrible like Ahab, and some not so bad like Jehu, but still, they were not ever faithful to the Lord. And God kept warning them through prophets. He sent them Elijah, he sent them Hosea, he sent them others who said, if you don't get back to God and the covenant, God is going to eventually deal with you. He's patient, but he's not patient forever. And what happened? In 721, the northerners were conquered. In fact, throughout the 700s, if you really look at the scriptures, and if you look at Assyrian records, throughout the 700s BC, little groups were taken off. The northern groups were taken off first in the 760s and then the 740s. And eventually in 721, all of them were rounded up in Samaria and taken off and dispersed. And they were dropped off to the north in southern Turkey and northern Iraq and in the country of Iran. And where they went, conventional history says we don't know what happened to them. I think we do. But we'll see. I'm not going to get into that today, but I don't think those people disappeared. I think they are somewhere. They just don't know who they are. Judah in the south was sometimes faithful and sometimes not. King Hezekiah was pretty decent. Josiah was excellent. Joash was pretty good. But then they had some bad ones. Manasseh and Amon, they were just horrible. They led them into demonic things. And again, the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, went to them and said, if you don't get back to the covenant, God is going to deal with you too. You remember what happened to Israel? That's going to happen to you. They didn't listen. So the kingdom is divided, Judah in the south and Israel in the north. God sent writing prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, all of those people. He also sent prophets who didn't leave us any books, but we know they were there. Nathan, Elijah, Elisha, Huldah, the female prophet, and so on. So we have Judah alone from 722 or so till 606. We talked about the bad king Manasseh, good king Hezekiah. Joash attempted a revival but was killed because of his foolishness. And after Josiah, it was all downhill. The Babylonians then eventually came and took them all away into Babylon for 70 years. Jeremiah 25 said ahead of time, you will be in captivity 70 years. How long were they in captivity? From 606 to 536 BC. What do you know? It's 70 years. We'll leave off there because now we're halfway through. I've got to save something for next week.